Have you been over before?
Not for animals.
Yeah. Not for this style of hunting. Welcome to episode 102 of the Hunt Backcountry podcast, presented by Exo Mountain Gear. This podcast and the gear that we produce at Exo Mountain Gear share the same purpose: to make you a more capable, confident, and successful backcountry hunter. Straight to the point, no fluff, and no BS, this show is all about providing you with valuable information from experienced hunters. To learn more about the podcast or about our backcountry hunting packs, please visit exomountaingear.com. Before we dive into tonight's episode, I wanted to remind you guys about the episode 100 giveaway that's going on right now as this show is released. You have until December 1st. That's when the winners will be drawn, so get in this month of November and get your entries in for an Exo Mountain Gear pack, gear from our friends at First Light, Black Gold, Tight Spot, and more than a dozen others. 15 prizes up for grabs, just to say thank you to you guys for supporting the show. So go to exomountaingear.com/100. You'll get all the details there and learn how to enter. Our guest on this episode tonight is Eddie Edmondson. He is a 20-plus year veteran of the Special Operations in the United States military and brings some unique perspective that we are super excited to share with you guys. So with Eddie, we talk about stealth and stalking and get some shooting lessons, as well as much more, including some incredibly helpful thoughts and advice on mindset. You actually hear that we wrap up this show, and we thought we were going to wrap it up, but then kind of got into some more discussion afterwards that was actually helpful. Thankfully, we were still recording, so we actually let that play on and get even to more goodness with Eddie. So he's one of these guys. He's a quiet professional, but he has so much wisdom to share. We are super excited to share it with you guys. All right, let's get right into it with Eddie Edmondson. Eddie, welcome to the Hunt Backcountry podcast. Thanks for joining us, man.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yeah, excited to get into it. We were just chatting before we hit record. Steve and I are just coming off of the Exo Death Hike last weekend, but you were just telling us you just got done from doing quite the trek yourself, and that was in New Mexico, you said?
Yeah, it was just outside of Cimarron. I was with my son, who's 13, and then we had four of the boys. It was with the Boy Scouts. So it ended up being 100-plus miles. And, I mean, we live here at sea level in North Carolina, so I think we were starting out about 6'8", and several of the days we were going from 7'5", up to 11, 12,000.
Wow.
So yeah, I mean it's a good warm up for this fall.
Yeah, 100 sure. Miles is quite the warm up. That's for dang sure. How many days was that you guys covered 100 miles? Was like a week?
Yeah, a little over a week. We had a couple of slow days on the front and the back just for administrative purposes.
Yeah. Wow. So did the.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just gonna say, did the boys have any issues with elevation coming from sea level? I know you have more experience getting out and about and around, but how were they?
They were good. Again, you know, first couple of days a little huffing and puffing, but they picked it up quick and you know went at the pace that they could go. They were pushing or they were carrying between like 45 and 55 pounds. And,
wow.
Jeez.
And probably weighing what, 140, 150 or something?
My son's right at 100 and he was carrying 45.
Oh, wow. At 100 pounds?
Yeah.
Wow.
That's impressive.
Yeah, that is impressive.
I was surprised. I'm surprised and amazed, but they got stronger as they went.
Yeah. Wow.
It was good. It was a good experience for all of them.
Yeah, I bet.
I bet.
Well, that's cool. I had to hear about that for sure. Let's go ahead and back up for the listeners, Eddie. And if you could just kind of give us an intro, a background, tell us a little bit about your story, experience that I'm sure we'll get into a bit later this evening, and then also how you've got into hunting, if you don't mind.
Yeah, I'm a retired military. I did special operations for 21 of the 23 years plus that I was in. And the last 18 of that were in a special mission unit. And we did operations all over the world. Pretty much counterterrorism, manhunting, that kind of thing. And see, I guess prior to that, I mean, I grew up in Virginia, and started hunting there. And that, if you've never hunted on the East Coast, there's a lot of shotguns, dogs, that kind of thing. And I quickly grew out of that, picked up bow hunting, and I haven't picked up a gun to hunt an animal in 20 years.
How was that transition? You did it pretty young. I mean, how was it going from a gun to a bow? And that's quite a while ago. What were things like back then, bow hunting?
I mean, shoot, the bows were nowhere near as efficient. They were probably 50% efficient, where now I think they're running 98%. You know, big heavy arrows, aluminum. I don't even think they had carbon then at that point. Maybe, or you were paying stupid money for carbon.
Yeah.
But yeah, I picked up a bow. It just wasn't my thing hunting with a gun, and I'd prefer to be by myself. And so I picked up bow hunting, and then just progressed. And then once I got in the military, I spent so much time with guns that the thrill wasn't there. So I just stopped altogether.
Yeah.
Occasionally I'll do waterfowl hunting and have a shotgun in the timber, or hunting over decoys in a field. But as far as hunting big game, it's been 20 years.
Mm. Yeah. So one of the things that we wanted to get into with you, and just, I hate to make too many parallels between military experiences and hunting, because they're clearly very different, but at the same time, someone with your experience certainly has a unique perspective, and you can bring that to hunting, as I know that you have done personally. And I think that, you know, Steve and I can benefit, our listeners can benefit from your experience and from some of the lessons that you've learned. And I know that Steve and I were kind of talking about your mindset is so much different than that of your average hunter. So if we could just kind of start there, I would love to just get into your head, kind of understand your dialogue, understand your frame of mind when you're going into a backcountry hunt and pursuing an animal. So I know that's kind of an open-ended question, but I would love to just to hear about how you make that approach mentally, because I think that there's probably some lessons there that we can glean.
Yeah. With, you know, there are quite a lot of parallels. Once you find your animal, or you find your target that you're looking for, there's a couple key things. One, you have to find a way in without being detected, and then you have to be able to get in close enough or within your effective range. And then if it's not working or the conditions change, you have to be able to get out without being detected, without spoiling it. And it doesn't matter if it's whitetail or even, you know, our Western game. And the way I look at it, having done, you know, reconnaissance and things like that overseas, is that if you screw it up, at a minimum, the mission is blown. At its worst, you know, now you're in a fight and you're typically outnumbered, because we operate in small teams. So if you think about it, if you're there with your buddy or you're filming, there's two of you, it's the same kind of thing. And so I treat the animal like he has the same opportunity that, you know, they're hunting me. So I approach it from that same mentality. So I tend to slow down and constantly reevaluate. I make a plan, start moving, reevaluate as the conditions change. Of course, the plan changes, and that's the same in the military. And when things are completely not in your favor. You have to be willing to say this isn't the right time, and then you back out. But you have to do so without, you know, without burning it. So that's kind of, I guess, the thing is that I give the animal equal footing when it comes to that. Like, he has the opportunity. He's hunting me. He has the same opportunity to catch me as I do going after him. And it forces me to slow down, whether I'm with a camera or not. It forces me to slow down, go a lot slower, constantly reevaluating. I've started using gillies, especially for the spot and stalk out west, which, you know, can be hot, can be cumbersome, but the advantages of having that 3D effect and being able to change it as the terrain changes, you can add or take away natural vegetation from it. And we've been able to crawl in ridiculously close or across open areas that otherwise you couldn't do. And I don't know if there's too many people out there that are using the ghillie suits. And that's just, again, it's another lateral transfer from the military.
Mm-hmm. What species have you used that approach with?
Pronghorn and mule deer. Mule deer most recently. Yeah, we ended up doing, it was up in Alberta. We did a close to a mile and a half in about 6 hours in the open prairie right in front of two mule deer that were bedded on a bank looking out over the prairie.
Wow. That's amazing. That's wild. I mean, something that we've both talked before several times, Steve, is patience and how sometimes we struggle with that, or sometimes, you know, we just struggle with it. And it sounds like, Eddie, from your experience and your approach, that having patience is not an issue because of the way that you treat the approach. I'm assuming that's largely true.
It is. It's one of those things. You got to be willing to say, you know, now's not the right time, and you know, it may be the last day of the hunt. Sometimes you'll push it, and you end up blowing it. But you know, if it means stopping, backing up, and going around another half mile to a mile and starting over again, then that's what it takes. And again, you know, it's the stuff we do overseas. It's slow. It's methodical. It's typically, you know, within sight of people that are looking for you just as much as you're looking for them.
How do you evaluate a stalking or an approach opportunity, Eddie? And before you commit to it, how are you evaluating the opportunity in terms of the viability of that, the opportunity of success, the opportunity of conditions blowing that stalk? You know, do you sort of have any personal rules on determining, well, if I think 75% chance I'm good, I'll go, but if there's 25% of X, Y, or Z blowing this, I won't? Do you have any sort of rules, or just feeling that situation out? Kind of take us through that in terms of committing to whether or not this is a stalkable animal.
Yeah, you know, you look at it and you figure, you know, is he in a stalkable position? You know, where you guys, like, sometimes you guys are in the mountains, you can come down from above. Where I was last was in the prairies of Alberta, and there really was no above. It was, you know, face to face. So, you know, you evaluate the time of day, the wind, the sun, all those things. You know, is there going to be a glint off of my glasses, or, you know, off my scope, or, you know, whatever it happens to be, and be willing to, you know, get into a position where, you know, right now with the current conditions that I have, I can't do anything. I'm just going to have to wait here for the next couple of hours until things change, and then continue, or be willing to back out. So I don't know if it's really a percentage other, or if it's just, you know, from where I'm sitting right now, it doesn't look like it, but my best possible chance would be approach from this direction and go take a look at it and see what I can get away with without busting the target. And that's the big thing is not alerting them to what you're doing. Cause if you get all the way in and it doesn't work, you have to be able to get all the way out. or lay there and wait until they leave, and then you can get away, and hopefully they don't come back and pick up where you were. And like I said, whether it's whitetail or western game, same kind of thing. Whitetail here a little more harder to pick up on. You've got a lot more vegetation. Well, you live there in Missouri, so you've got the woodlands and stuff. But we have no, where I'm at here in North Carolina, we have no vegetation, or excuse me, no agriculture, and it's all pines. So the deer are more, free ranging. So if they pick up on where you've been going in and out, you might as well forget about it around here.
That's a good point alone, just in terms of stealth, not only on making a specific stalk, but just on making your presence known in general in the field. And that can apply whether, you're hunting whitetail in North Carolina or where I'm at in Missouri, or, whether we're out in an area in the mountains for a week, just kind of keeping an entirely low profile so that the animal just doesn't know you're there, period, and you're changing their patterns. That's good for sure.
Yeah, the less animals you educate, the better off you'll be. Again, it's the same overseas. You start bumping into the villagers and things like that, the word's going to get out, and it just makes it so much harder to do your job. So you bump an animal here, and it's where, I've seen it where it turns into like dominoes, or here in North Carolina, it looks like a jailbreak. Mm-hmm. And there's animals going everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the ghillies, and one thing I did want to talk about was kind of cover and concealment. Often as hunters, we're kind of essentially just relying on commercial camouflage patterns, things like that. And I think in some instances, camouflage can or cannot matter. But beyond the ghillie, is there anything, any tactics that you take, any specific strategies you take in terms of cover and concealment, whether that be stationary or with movement?
The majority of the stuff out there is kind of dark. So it could happen even with a ghillie. If you're coming in with the sun at your back, which ideally you want, there's a good chance that your body is going to create a natural shadow anyway. So you're trying to, there's a couple things you're looking for: shape, shine, your color palette. Ideally, you want to be a little bit lighter, because it'll pick up the background. I tend to stick to the shadows. That way my body isn't casting a big hulking shadow. And you guys know, if you're walking the ridge lines, you stick out like a sore thumb. So if you have to cross those, you're crossing at a less obvious place further away, or you're on your stomach when you go over the top. If you have anything that you can use to screen, whether it's sage or a tree trunk or a rock or anything like that, I tend to look around or through those things versus stand up and look over the top, or like on a tree, standing up and looking over around the side of it. You look more like cancer sticking out the side of the tree. So lowering that profile typically does a lot. And then, like I said, sticking to the lighter colors, which don't blob, and they don't appear dark. And then they tend to absorb and mimic the backgrounds, the muted colors that of the natural vegetation.
Yeah, I've never thought about the lighter color aspect to it. I mean, it makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, just if you ever, if you've ever been around military, the old school, BDU uniform, that dark green, dark brown, that was extremely dark. And as soon as it got wet or sweaty, it turned almost black. And, having looked through a scope, finding people for years, black is not something that is natural. And so think about black boots, black gloves, black beanies, black weapon, all those things stick out. So that lighter color, think about what color the animals are. They've got that lighter hue to them.
Mm-hmm. And as you said, it kind of those lighter colors can kind of reflect the environment that's around it, which certainly something dark doesn't, it can't. I mean, it can't really reflect that. It's just going to stand out and blob, as you mentioned.
Yep. There you go, it blobs.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. What about scent? Because that's something that's somewhat unique to hunting. I'm just curious, based on your field experience, do you rely on any sort of scent control? Are you kind of in the camp of there's not much you can do other than play the wind? What's been your experience there?
The first thing is, would be playing the wind, but you know, I mean, you know how fickle that is in the mountains. And we get it here with shifting fronts and all that, but you know, I try to stay clean. If I can take a shower, I do. You're not going to hide everything. The one thing I started doing a few years ago was using an ozonics with the ozone, and I've used it in the mountains. Even when they didn't have the new system that they have out now, I just tied it onto the back of my pack and just had it blowing. So if the wind did shift, hopefully it would knock down some of my scent. But I mean, you know, in the mountains, you're not going to, you know, you can't keep clean. You can, who wants to haul spray bottles and all that stuff? So you're worried about the wind, the thermals, all those things that you normally take into. But I did start using an ozone machine, and I did see, especially on the whitetails, I did see an increase of closer encounters. They can pick up something because there is a smell to it. It's kind of a muted chlorine kind of a smell, but it's not a threatening smell, and I guess it breaks apart the human scent molecules to something that, instead of being 30 yards away, maybe it makes them feel like you're 300 yards away from them. And we've messed around with that because the ozone kills, you know, bacteria and viruses and all that kind of stuff. So if you think about like a locker room, how bad that smells, you run an ozone machine in there and you come back in and open the doors and you don't smell a locker room anymore. So it breaks down the human scent molecules and destroys them. There are certain fabrics that do deteriorate over time. I think they're, rubber, petroleum based, elastic, kind of, things that do break down over time. But, we used them overseas because you can only, you know, rinse your stuff out so many times and it still smells like a locker room. Whether it's, diluted bleach or whatever, laying out in the sun, it still has a smell to it. We put it in a bag, throw an ozone machine in there, or just throw everything in a room, lock the door, and run the machine in there for 4 or 5 hours, and it doesn't smell like a locker room anymore.
Yeah, I've seen those, but I've never personally used one, and I've heard some good experience with them. That's certainly something I consider for hunts that aren't up in the mountains and are a bit more stationary, for sure. That'd be interesting.
Yeah, like I said, I've used them in the mountains. You know, I'm playing the thermals, I'm playing the wind, but you know how that happens.
Right.
One up and then it sucks back down, and so I'm running it, and it's going uphill, as I'm coming down on an animal. But hopefully, when and if it does reverse, there's enough dilution as that ozone goes over top of me that it gives me a chance that maybe I can get the full draw, or maybe they'll say, well, that's not close enough.
Yeah, I think it's almost I see a lot of similarities between trying to control scent, and some similarities between what you try and do with camouflage or concealment. And, obviously scent's much harder to control because you with ghillies or with effective use of shadows, you can eliminate your presence further than you could your scent presence. But with both of those, I think what you can do most effectively is buy yourself some time or buy yourself some space. Exactly. Make your presence less known, whether that's by scent or by appearance. I think that's about all you can do with scent, especially, is just make it seem less threatening, less in their face, and maybe buy you a little bit of time.
Yep. Yep, exactly. What I have seen on whitetails, whether it's the Midwest or even here, is your does typically get curious trying to figure out what is that different smell. They're not alarmed by it. And they'll come closer and they're looking around and then they realize, well, there's nothing here, and they go on about their business. But your bucks, they don't freak out and leave the area. They don't close on you like a doe will. They'll just look around and realize, well, nobody else is panicking. And then, they go about their business, but they're not as curious about it as does. And I mean, it's my observation. And, it could be different for somebody else, depending on, what your situations are.
So I'm curious, Eddie, what other experiences, we've talked a bit about tactics and kind of some field craft type stuff, but what other experiences or lessons, or even more mindset stuff from your background do you think has helped you be as effective as you are hunting? I mean, I'm not going to even pretend to know about everything you've been through, everything you've learned, but I'm just curious if there's anything else that stands out to you. Because you've been very effective in the field hunting. Anything else that stands out is coming from your military experiences that's helped you be successful?
I'd probably say, the big thing is the mental side of the game. Some of the things I do now, I work with college and professional athletes, and it's all about the psychological aspects of the game. And some people are wired differently. Some people, and you probably, I'm sure you've known or been around somebody, they miss a shot and their confidence is done. They're mentally out of the hunt at that point. The mental side of the game for me is that there is no quit. There is no, I can't do this, or I can't go any further. That's never an option. If not to say that, I give up because I can't get any closer. Well, I just got to find a better way. I got to find a different way. This one isn't working. And if that means coming all the way back out and working all the way back around, then that's what it takes. Or if it means coming back tomorrow. But it's the mental side of the game. And, I teach rifle and pistol part time, and it's one of the things that I talk about is it's 90% mental and 10% physical. You don't have to be, a bodybuilder in order to shoot a rifle or a pistol. You don't have to, be able to carry 150 pounds in order to go hunt. You don't have to, run an ultra marathon in order to do it, but you have to have the mental toughness that when things aren't going your way, that you have to solve that problem and find the right answer. And that's what I see, especially with a lot of younger hunters, is that they miss a shot or something doesn't work out and they are done, or at least for that day, if not even more.
Do you find that that's something that can be coached, or is it more just inherent in a person as a trait?
I would almost say it's inherent. I call it, when I'm talking to the athletes, I call it drive versus talent. So I can teach you a skill, but I can't teach the drive part of it. That you have to have that in you. And if that's not part of your game, or say you've never been pushed, when you're doing something and all of a sudden you run into an obstacle, whether it's a person or it's a mountain or it's a situation that you're in and it crushes you. And now you've never faced defeat before. Well, a lot of times those people, crumble and they fade away on you. So it has to, the way I've seen it, it's the drive part, and you can't teach that. That has to be something that's in you. I guess it's, mediocrity is unacceptable. I did it perfect, but I can do it better next time.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I mean, I always kind of enjoy pondering things on those topics, and you know, you look at different traits, and is it inherited? Is it innate, or can it be developed? And certainly, I don't think someone else can give you that drive. But man, when I look at my own life, I think it can be developed and strengthened for sure.
Yeah, you can definitely strengthen it, but it, like you said, it can't. Somebody can't teach it to you.
Yeah. Right.
That makes sense.
You have to have that want all the time. You know, take it when you're shooting your bow. You started out shooting 20 and 40, and then all of a sudden, you know, I want to push it to 50, 60, 70, 100. And now you can group it 100. So I'm going to push it to 120, 130. I'm doing great. I'm doing far better than everybody else that I, you know, see shooting. But I want them to make this better. You know, if I can hold a 5-inch group at 100, why can't I hold a 3-inch group at 100? So mm-hmm. whether it's tinkering with your gear, slight adjustments to your rest, tweaking your arrows, whatever it happens to be, you keep pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing, because it's never good enough.
We want to take a minute to thank our good friends at First Light for helping make this show happen. I tell you what, guys, I was out in Missouri whitetail hunting this past week and weekend and had an absolute blast. But a key piece, especially for you guys that might be sitting in a tree stand or doing some non-active hunts, is the Sanctuary series from First Light. So clearly on the show, we talk a lot about Western hunting, which is more active hunting, and First Light really has excellent gear for that. But they have given the whitetail hunters some love as well, and the Sanctuary series is key for cold stationary hunts. Finally, you can be warm enough and be quiet at the same time. I'm telling you guys, this stuff is so cleverly designed. Check out the Sanctuary bibs and Sanctuary top from First Light if you're tired of freezing in your tree stand. Going back to Eddie, specifically those guys who get, you know, they get down on the hunt, whether it's because they miss a shot, whether it's because they're not seeing animals, you know, it really, in one way to put it, I think, is like a lack of just resiliency, that when things get tough, that you're just not resilient, mm-hmm. or you're not, at least you're not behaving with resiliency. What are some ways that you think that can be strengthened? Again, can't clearly be taught, and nobody else can just give it to you. But guys who identify with what you described, man, I do just struggle when I miss a shot, or I'm not in it when things don't go my way. How do you think we personally can take it upon ourselves to put ourselves in situations to grow in that or challenge that?
Hunting is not life and death. So, you know, a failure is just another data point that you use to get better. If I miss a shot or I blow a stalk or something like that, I'm constantly reevaluating, going, what caused me to do that? Was it because the animal moved, because the range estimation, because I didn't practice hard enough? And I start, you know, reevaluating. And, you know, just, you know, the old saying, you know, once you fall off the horse, you got to get back on. It's the same thing. You have to keep on it. But I guess the easy way back is, you know, a high probability or a high success target, you know, and I wouldn't even say that, you know, instead of shooting a bull, I'm going to shoot a cow, or instead of a buck, shoot a doe. But, you know, something to help turn the corner on the confidence. But for me, I break it apart and reevaluate, you know, okay, I missed, but what was the reason why? And typically it's more than one thing, but you know, what can I control? What part of my regime did I not work hard enough on, or what was the failure point? And then, you know, go back and, you know, like your normal shot routine, you normally load an arrow, clip your release, range, whatever it happens to be, your normal routine. As soon as something throws you off of that, that's when mistakes happen. And that's you know, what we're doing overseas or you know, what we do in the mountains here hunting.
Yeah, that's good. I'm glad you mentioned shot routine, because certainly something I wanted to talk about is leaning on your experience, not only in the field shooting, but you mentioned you are an instructor as well, teaching things on the firearm side. What lessons can we apply from that to our hunting? So things like shot routine, again, could be mindset, it could be a specific technique, but, you know, especially when it comes to in the field at crunch time, making a good shot, any advice or just advice in general on practice, on routine, on mindset? I would just love to hear your thoughts on improving as shooters.
It doesn't matter the weapon that you're shooting. It honestly, the fundamentals are nearly identical. And, like when I'm teaching guys to shoot rifle and pistol, most of the people come out, they've got some experience on a gun and they all want to shoot fast. Well, the speed doesn't come until you have the fundamentals mastered. And, you know, again, think about, and I'm going to talk about, you know, real quick about rifle and pistol, but think about it with a bow. Stance, grip, presentation, you know, how you push the bow to the target, how you orient the gun, sight alignment, trigger control, and follow through. It doesn't matter the weapon system. So, when you have those fundamentals mastered, and you don't have to think about them anymore, you can focus on the target and, not making a mistake in your routine. It happens subconsciously. As soon as you start having to think about things, then everything slows down. It takes longer. And now you've got, you know, the perceived pressure because the animal's moving, whether it's, you know, laterally or getting closer or further away. When you start having to think about things, that's when the process gets screwed up. So like with your shot routine, if you whatever position you're in, as long as you can execute the fundamentals effectively with subconsciously without having to think about it, now your focus shifts to the animal. Your focus shifts to, you know, letting the sight pin settle or slightly wobble, because rarely can you ever hold it still. You have to accept that wobble. And you know, you have to surprise release, but it all goes back to fundamentals and it being able to do the things subconsciously without having to think through that process of step A, B, C, D, E, it flows nice and smooth.
So what's the best way to get to that point? Just repetition or?
Yep.
Exactly. Is there just repetition? Okay. Is it taking video of yourself and watching it and making sure you're doing things right or having someone point out flaws that you're making yourself? Does a coach really come in handy?
Yeah. Coaches work. And if you don't have that, or if you're the friends you shoot with, or if you're all on kind of like the same level, definitely using a camera and then analyzing it that way. Cause, you'll miss things, or your buddies will miss things, or there'll be something as simple as, and you've probably seen it where, you'll have people that'll draw, and then typically most people have a draw length that's too long. So it's they're overdrawing it. So now their shoulders are out of alignment, or you'll see that hip kick forward. And now it looks like their upper body's leaning backwards slightly, little things like that. Mm-hmm. A lot of people, cause they may do the same thing and it looks normal to them, or they've seen you do it for years. But then you look at it with a camera, you're like, wait a minute, I'm not even straight up and down. And why am I, you know, why is the string, you know, over on my cheek instead of by the tip of my nose?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the camera will pick up on all those little things. And if, you know, if you're flinching, if you're blinking, if you are, you know, dropping your bow hand, it doesn't matter what the weapon system is. The camera picks all that stuff up. For rifle and pistol, it's slapping the trigger. You know, everybody's got a little apprehension about the recoil, so they slap the trigger and they anticipate the recoil. We know the same thing happens with a bow. They get back there and it's, you know, I got to make it go off now. So they jerk on the trigger, or they're already dropping their bow handle to see where the arrow is going to hit. You know, it may not be, you may not see it with the naked eye, but you can definitely see it with the camera.
Gotcha.
Eddie, this is a total change in course, but you mentioning trigger just triggered this in my mind. What are your thoughts on single stage versus two stage triggers for rifles, specifically, you know, a hunting rifle?
I mean,
is it just personal preference, or?
Yeah, what I've seen most of the time with single stage triggers, people use them for competition shooting. And with two stage, there's typically a little bit of a take up. And like I'll say, like my ARs that I teach with, it's a two stage trigger. The first stage is 2.5 pounds, and then you hit the wall where the sear is fully loaded, and then it's 2 pounds to break it. Most of your sniper rifles are right around the 2 pound mark, and it's typically a single stage. So you can equate that to, you know, competition shooting where guys are shooting extended ranges, you know, for score. And, you know, one of the new things in the last couple of years are people that have, you know, shooting systems that allow them to reach out to, you know, 1,000, 1,500 yards. And, it's with very little training and somebody, you know, puts the dope on the gun, all you've got to do is, you know, not screw it up and just squeeze through the shot. Most of those are single stage. But like I said, I prefer a little bit of take up because I want to be able to feel where that the wall is on those. So I like a two stage.
Okay. Yeah, I've played around with both, and I'm way less experienced than you, but I kind of have fallen into that camp of enjoying the two stage, being able to kind of preload it, if you will, and then know that I'm right there for that final bit of pressure to send things off.
Yeah, like I said, the guys I see using single stage are the guys that shoot competition, three gun, that kind of thing. And, you know, it's the speed, speed versus accuracy, and they're willing to give up accuracy to be a little bit faster. From the camp that I came from, everything we did was based around accuracy. So the simple thing of, you know, if you pull the trigger, then the round needs to be exactly where you want it to be. You're responsible for every single round that leaves the gun. You're responsible for the ultimate resting place of that round. And if you jerk the trigger, if you're panicking and you're, you know, hammering away on the trigger and not focusing on accuracy, well, kind of the way we look at it is every time you miss, then either you or one of your friends has to pay the price for that. That gives them the opportunity to return that back in your direction. So it forces you to slow down that fraction of a second, which seems like an eternity when you're doing it. But, you know, you're talking tenths of a second that you let the sight settle and then you finish the squeeze instead of, you know, jerking the piss out of it. Which does nothing for accuracy. And again, think about, you know, whatever weapon system you want. If you slam on the trigger, chances are that the further out you get, the less accurate it is.
What's kind of the standard military? I mean, I'm trying to like put my head in that situation of you're pulling the trigger on something, and if you miss, it's going to shoot back at you. And that's a lot different than if you miss, the buck just runs off. What's like the military? How do you guys practice that? How do you practice that intensity, and just, you know, essentially buck fever of, you know, how do you prepare for that?
The first thing is, every time you pull the trigger, you're responsible for it. So it's all about accountability.
Yeah.
So if you're working on the fundamentals, typically we use a bull type target, you know, which has you know, the black center and then the scoreable rings that go out to the side. And, you know, once the gun is zeroed, then, you know, you're using that score to kind of judge your progress. And then as you become comfortable with the fundamentals, and then you start to, you know, let me push a little bit harder, a little bit harder, a little bit harder. We change the targets to more of a man type unmarked target. It's not overtly marked, but there are, it's still, you still hold yourself accountable. There's still scoreable rings there. And, you know, we'll shoot against each other, you know, on the range, there'll be parallel, training scenarios set up. So you're shooting one, you have to be accurate, and two, you're shooting against your, you know, your buddy to see who's going to be faster and accurate at the same time. And that continues to progress. You know, you go from day to night to, you know, you can shrink or lengthen the ranges. But we eventually get to the point of, it's similar to a paint gun, but it's like an, instead of being a ball, it's a 9mm or a 5.56mm, paint round. So you're shooting a paint bullet at each other, and, you know, you still have to be accurate. You, in the job I was in, if you miss a target, you lose your job. So mm-hmm. you learn to slow down and be as accurate as possible.
So is there things do you like to replicate that pressure that you do? I mean, do you know, that's what I'm trying to get at is like, I mean, just building up that intensity and the anticipation of if I screw this up and, you know, simple things like running and then trying to shoot fast. I mean, just like getting your heart rate elevated. Is there any tips or tactics there?
Oh yeah. We start out with, you know, just, you can call it like t-shirt and shorts and working on fundamentals. And then again, as you increase the tempo, you add, you know, now you're shooting against somebody. You still have to be accurate. Your time standards get faster and faster and faster. And then you add all the gear that you normally wear. And then, you know, mm-hmm. now I don't get the option of standing there on the range in a good aggressive stance. Now I have to shoot on the move. Now I have to be under the vehicle. Now I'm going over the vehicle. I'm shooting around something. So it's uncomfortable positions. It's shooting on the move. And then, you know, you add armor, you add all that, you know, we call it 100 pounds of lightweight kit. Last time I checked, 100 pounds wasn't lightweight to be running around.
Yeah, no.
And okay. It cuts down on your mobility. It taxes your, you know, everybody thinks about it being heavy on your shoulders, but it taxes your legs. You know, you got your thighs are eating up all that oxygen, so your breathing goes out the window. You have to be able to slow that down and control it. And again, fall back on the fundamentals of, mm-hmm. you know, hands, grip, presentation, sight alignment, trigger control, and follow through. And you have to be willing to accept the fact that it doesn't matter what I do, I cannot stop the weapon from moving. There's going to be movement in it at some point, but you have to relax and see through that and just let the sight pin wobble where it is, or let the sight wobble where it is and squeeze through it. And 99% of the time, the bullet's exactly where you want it to be. Even though your perception is that it's moving all over the place, and there's a lot behind that. It has to do with your, you know, where you focus, and as that focal plane shifts from, say, your sight pin to the target, back to your sight pin, it goes back and forth really fast. It gives the appearance that your sight's wobbling all over the place, when you should be focusing on the sight, and the target's going to be a little bit fuzzy in the background. And mm-hmm. you just accept that wobble and squeeze through it.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, it really, if you change like the context of everything you just said, it really directly applies. You know, you guys standing there hitting the bullseye in shorts and a t-shirt is, you know, guys standing on the range, whether that's archery or whether they're bench shooting their rifle, and that's the easy way to practice. That's how most of us practice, probably too much, but then, you know, as you were saying, Eddie, you throw your gear on, your body armor, your mag load out, things like that. You know, it's just like us throwing our pack on, shooting with our pack on, and you look at moving or getting in awkward positions. I mean, you guys talk about shooting under a car, but You know, that could be a hunting scenario where you're kneeling behind a log or what have you. So it's everything you just said about, you know, getting away from this comfortable, stationary practice routine, you know, and it's on us to make it more realistic. That's essentially what you guys are doing, is making your training more and more realistic as you progress.
Exactly. It starts with the fundamentals and then you move up from there. But it's always accuracy before speed. And, you know, every time that you're shooting, even if you only shoot one arrow, it's not, well, I'm just going to work. I'm going to, you know, going to warm up and stretch my shoulders out and get one arrow and then I'm gone. That one arrow needs to be perfect. If I'm going to pull the trigger on something, then it's going to be the most accurate shot that I can make, because I'm not going to get another one. And it's, I mess around on the range when, you know, the guys are shooting good and, you know, I'll have them switch from left-handed to right-handed, or, you know, vice versa. I have them switch to their offside and they're working through that. I'll have my bow back at 100 yards and I'm shooting groups on the same bull that they're shooting with their rifle. And a lot of time, you know, a lot of them are kind of, you know, well, we're shooting a 4-inch group at 100 yards, and so are you. And I'm like, it's the same fundamentals. So it's, mm-hmm. Like I said from the beginning, it doesn't matter the weapon system. It's the nearly identical. And like you said, Mark, the training is exact same thing. You know, I get it zeroed. I'm building that muscle strength. I'm working on the fundamentals. Okay. So I've got that down. I know I can shoot the dots at 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70. Well, now I'm going to do it from my knees. Now I'm going to do it, you know, with, you know, torque in my upper body where I'm, you know, having to twist around the tree or around the rock. I'm going to put my pack on. So now I've got a little bit of hindrance, you know, in my shoulders. Think about the ghillie. When you wear the ghillie, you, for me as a right hand shooter, with the bow in the left hand, I have to clean everything off the inside of that, that left sleeve. You know, little things like that. You keep adding all the tools that you use. You have to put them into that training routine. The last thing you want is the day you need it is the very first time that you ever used it.
How do you put all that together, Eddie? And kind of use those data points, use your practice, assess your skill level, assess your confidence through all different types of shooting. And how do you equate that to a personal, like max effective distance or comfortable distance? Not asking what that distance is for you, because it doesn't matter, but just guiding guys through, like, personally, if they do practice this way, I mean, do you just feel that, you know, each shot opportunity you evaluate on its own and gauge your comfort and confidence level? Do you go into a particular hunt knowing the animal, knowing the terrain, with a specific limit on your shooting distance? How does that play out for you personally?
Probably like you guys, I push the limit on practice so that, you know, if I'm practicing at 120, 130 yards, it makes the closer shots, you know, almost feel like, you know, like shooting fish in a barrel. It becomes a lot easier because I've built that tolerance to accept the wobble at long range. It makes the close range look like there's very little movement at all. And there's no rush. But as far as the situation, you know, around here, you don't expect to shoot too far. Out west, you expect to shoot a little bit further. So I have the confidence to shoot a little bit further. I prefer to get closer or get as close as possible. But like with, you know, with mule deer antelope, I like to be out there in the 40, 50, 60 yard range just because of the fact that they can see and smell so well. And you know, it's harder to get away with anything when you get inside, when it's that open and you get that close. But I just evaluate it with, you know, what's going on. You know, is it strong wind? Is it a full value? Is it coming 90 degrees across the front where I'm going to get maximum deflection on the arrow? you know, is it coming from the front or from the back where there's going to be minimal effect? You know, what, where am I at in the hunt? Am I stretching 5 days into eight? And so I have, you know, a little dehydrated, little, you know, lack of food, you know, a little less stable. You know, I just reevaluate every single time. How am I feeling right now? Can I do this? And, you know, make the decision right then. But, you know, probably like you guys, I practice at longer ranges than most people are comfortable, but it's not that I want to shoot it that far. It's to force me, on the fundamentals. The further out you shoot, the bigger the weakness you pick up in your fundamentals.
Mm-hmm. Everything's magnified.
Exactly. So like with a pistol, most people think of a pistol as, you know, 10 yards and in. We start at 25 because everything is exponentially magnified from 10 to 25. You know, 10, you look like a rock star. You can bang away on the trigger and you just got to barely see the sights. But at 25, everything has to be perfect. And typically at the end of the week, we're shooting our pistols at 100, 200 yards and still hitting a 10 by 15 inch steel plate at, you know, 150, 200 yards with a pistol. But that's all fundamentals. I don't want to shoot a pistol that far, but I know if I can hit that plate that I'm doing everything right on the fundamentals. Exact same thing with a bow. I'm pushing that distance to force myself, you know, we'll say 100 yards to hold an 8-inch group. You know, so I'm kind of my measuring stick, my accountability, and I can typically shoot better than that, but that kind of, you know, forces me that, you know, I know that I'm screwing something up if I can't do this, you know, and I hold myself accountable at every range like that.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I mean, distance is a diagnostic. I mean, it just shows you what's going on and what's going wrong. But obviously before you push to that point, you need to have a baseline, right? So you need to be able to do it close and then move the distance and then diagnose what's going wrong and where and how do you fix it.
Exactly. Like I said, it's fundamentals. If you don't have that fundamental base, it doesn't matter how far you are, you know, how much you paid for your whole setup. It none of that matters.
If you spend more, it doesn't buy accuracy.
Nope.
Man, I've been led to believe a lie.
But I mean, you know the deal. If you buy better stuff, typically your tolerances are tighter and all that. But you have to do your part to it. You know, if you have the straightest arrow, but it's the wrong spine. If you have your arrow rest, you know, a 16th of an inch out, you won't notice it at 20, 30, 40, 50, but at 100, you look like an idiot.
Mm-hmm.
Because everything's, you know, going off to the side. You know, little things like that.
Man, nearly an hour has flown by quick. Before we wrap up, I'd just love to hear a hunt that you... Let's do this. Either a hunt that you're super stoked on, a memory from this past fall, or just a hunt that you're headed into this year that you're really excited about.
This past fall was nothing for me here. I got wrapped up in work last year for a lot of hunting season, so it was all here local and didn't see anything big enough. The shoot saw a lot of deer, just not big enough. But I do have next month coming up in August. I'm going, you know, I film and hunt for Elite Archery on their TV show on Sportsman's Channel, and we're heading to Africa in August.
Nice.
And me and, you guys probably remember Anthony Dixon.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We're heading there, and then there's a few other guys from the outdoor group, and I think there's two other guys that are there's some kind of an auction to go. So we've got a couple of weeks in Africa lined up.
That's cool. Which, have you been over before?
You know, not for animals.
Yeah, not for this style of hunting.
Yeah.
What country are you headed to for this?
We're heading to South Africa, and most of our work is in on the northern side between, you know, Mali and the Horn there in Somalia, all across that northern tier with Egypt and Libya and, you know, the whole northern part is where we work. So everything's down south. And, you know, we haven't really decided on animals yet, but you know, it's something different. So I'm pretty stoked about that.
That's cool. A really good friend of mine just got back from Africa a week or two ago, and it was fun seeing his photos and hearing his stories. And it was, it was way more, adventurous than I was picturing. You know, sometimes when you think of Africa, you just think of these box tents where you just, you know, sit in a blind and whatever comes in, and you essentially shoot it and pay for it. But there's actually some legit, like, really cool adventurous hunting opportunities over there. So it made me that much more excited to get over there one day.
Yep, that was one of the things that Anthony and I are talking about, because we work together whenever we can. And it was both of us right off the bat where we don't want to sit in a box blind all day and have the PH go, oh, you can shoot that one. We want to, you know, do the same thing we do out west, do the spot and stalk, get in close, find the animal, you know, find the right angle to get in amongst all the other eyes and make that shot. And I know that, you know, potentially depending on where you're at, could be a little dangerous, but like you said, I don't want to sit in a, box all day and have a guy go, yeah, shoot that one right there. That's not what I'm doing it for.
Right. Yeah. They were hunting They were hunting zebra, but up in the mountains, which I was like, really? Like, zebra in the mountains? But the terrain was legit, like, from the pictures, and I had no idea how big zebras can get, but it was like 1,000 pounds. Packing out a quarter of that was like, he said it was worse than elk quarters by far. But yeah, it's pretty interesting, man. So I hope you guys have a great trip.
Yeah, that was mountain zebra and kudu were two of the animals that I had, you know, thought about, you know, were two of the things that were on my list. I'd, you know, with all the other, you know, giraffe or elephant or nothing like that, I'm really not interested in, but those were two of the things. And, you know, everybody has a misconception that the zebra is a horse. Those things are not a horse. They are
big freaking, you know, beast.
Exactly. They will bite you, kick you. And I mean, they look similar to a horse, but you know, not the same animal at all.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely a wild animal for sure. Cool. Eddie, I know that you, fly under the radar, in a lot of ways, but is there any resources or anything that you would want to point listeners to go check out or to learn about you or your teaching, anything like that?
I don't know. I teach here at a range in North Carolina called the Range Complex. It's South Central North Carolina near Fayetteville. Other than that, everything is, you know, word of mouth, you know, working with, you know, small companies or, you know, being contacted, you know, from a friend of a friend kind of thing.
We really appreciate your time. We'll have to maybe get you back on and talk Africa or something one day.
All right. That works.
Cool. I think we cut it there. That was good stuff.
Man, it's so hard to get into that, like the real mental side of everything. Just, it's hard to chat through that.
Yeah, it when I'm working with the athletes, typically it starts out as an observation for a day or two, and then just kind of seeing the dynamics, seeing the personalities, and you know, typically it's been hockey players. So, you know, you've got your big brutes, you know, your 6'2", 220-pound guys, and they've always been bigger and stronger and don't work real hard. Comparatively speaking, they work hard, but they never push or, like, you know, you see guys who do just enough to be faster than everybody else. And, you know, it's always been that way. I've never had to, you know, never had to push myself to my full extent. And, mm-hmm. you know, as soon as those guys run into a wall, everything crumbles on them because now, oh, wait a minute, I just lost something. You know, I just got beat. And I do it with a 5-pound weight. You know, we're just sitting there talking, and I'll grab a 5-pound weight and give it to one of those guys, you know, and just hold that out to your side. And typically they go about 30 or 40 seconds, and then the pain adds up in their shoulder and they put it down. I'm like, well, why'd you put it down? And I'll pick it up and I'll hold it out there and I'll start talking about the mental side of the game. And next thing you know, we're a minute, minute and a half, 2 minutes. And then, I'll look at it and I'll go, oh yeah, I kind of forgot about that. And I'll keep talking. And then I'll start asking them questions or giving them details. Like, you know, you do realize I'm twice your age. I've been shot multiple times. I've been in multiple helicopter crashes. You know, you guys have a personal physician, you have a dietitian, you have a masseuse, you have someone that tells you when to get up, when to go to bed, what to eat, what to lift, how to lift, and all those things. But yet, as soon as it hurt, you decided to put the weight down. Why is that? And you start to see the gears turning. And I said, you know, I'll look over and I'll say, you think this doesn't hurt right now? You're damn right it hurts. But there's no way that you're going to beat me, no matter how much it hurts. And so some of them get it and you see the gears starting to turn. And then we go on to another subject and then we take a break and you'll see them challenging each other. I'm like, no, now it doesn't matter because you know what the game is. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you chose when it hurt, you chose to quit. Well, that's never an option. You know, it doesn't matter how much it hurts, how far it is, how heavy it is, how long it is. It does not matter. Quitting is never the option. And, you know, those people that have never been in the Hurt Locker and had to work through that, you know, whether it's lifting weights or, you know, sprints or swimming or whatever it is, carrying loads, if they've never had to work through that wall and then continue on, because your body will do way more than you think it will. Those guys that have never experienced that, they are the first ones to fold on you. So, yeah. I mean, that's that mental game.
Yeah. I mean, I think that so much of that just parallels and ties right into hunting. You know, it's just.
Yeah, I was just thinking that was all still recording. I think I'm going to have to pull that chunk out and throw it back in the episode.
Yeah.
That's good
Absolutely,
stuff.
Absolutely, yeah.
But that's like I was saying, that there's so many parallels, you know, whether it's shooting or it's conditioning or it's mindset. On overseas, you got the guy has an equal opportunity to hunt you down. So I give that same perspective to the animal and, you know, slowing down, crawling in, you know, analyzing it, being willing to say, this ain't going to work. I'm going to stop now. You know, not letting pride or like, you know, this is on film. I've got to push. I've got to keep going. You got to be willing to go, no, this ain't going to work.
Yeah. Yeah. That's one thing you said earlier was just like, you know, reanalyzing just constantly of the situation and adjusting as necessary. And, because you and I have talked a little bit about this over the year, the last couple of years, and I definitely try to apply that stuff to my hunting now of just that slowing down and taking that patience and, as I said, if it doesn't work, back out and try it again or wait another day and treat every opportunity there. Like, you know, if it doesn't work out, you know, you're dead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think there's a danger in like, you know, you assess the situation, put a plan together and you commit to it, which is all good and well, but then if variables change, you have to not be so stubborn or so blind that your plan might need to change.
Yep. Yeah. When overseas is kind of a joke, but everybody goes, you can have the perfect plan, but no plan survives the first gunshot. Things will change. You know, the first time you get punched in the face, you're going to reassess your plan.
Well, guys, thank you as always so much for listening. Again, be sure to visit exomountaingear.com/100 to enter the big giveaway that's going on right now through the month of November. We'll be drawing those winners on December 1st. As always, if you have any other questions, comments, or feedback, shoot us an email, podcast@exomountaingear.com. And if you're enjoying the show, please consider leaving us a review in iTunes, on Stitcher, or wherever else you might be listening to this. Thanks for listening.